Hi, I'm Al Lowe, and I'm listening to Adventure Game Hotspot.
Welcome back, or welcome front if it's the first time joining us. I am Joshua. That is Jack.
Hello, I think he's pointing at me. I don't know. He's pointing in the wrong direction on my screen, but
oh man, he was dodging, or I was being dodgy. This is the Adventure Game Hotspot podcast. We're going to have a good one for you today. We have Julia Minamata. You may know her talking about her wonderful game, Crimson Diamond. We'll get to her shortly. But as of right now, Jack, what's been going on in the world of adventure games over the last 2 weeks?
You know, I was about to say it's kind of a slow time. Summer tends to be, but then when I started putting together my notes for today, I'm going, no, it hasn't. There is no real slow time. It is sort of a little bit of a dip, but no, there's still lots going on. Like we just hit our posted our monthly preview, video preview, and there's lots of great stuff coming out in August. There's a new Agatha Christie. There's a new underwater game, which I love anything underwater, but published by Quantic Dream. So that has got a lot of pedigree behind it. A really slick looking sci-fi thriller called Fort Solace and a whole bunch of other stuff. So, and we've had some neat stuff out too. We've just had a Western co-op game called Whispers in the West come out. We had the debut of Telltale's and Deck Nine's The Expanse. So that's kind of got people talking. And there's been some Monkey Island stuff too. The mobile release of Return to Monkey Island. Joshua, you know a little bit about something. There was an expansion for Sea of Thieves called The Legend of Monkey Island that I know you played and streamed.
Yeah, the Sea of Thieves, Legend of Monkey Island, it was very exciting. I'm actually a partner for the game and really enjoyed it. Got played it twice in the first day, and we're expecting another episode to be released. Gosh, we're going to be going on it, 13 days from now? Very, very excited about that. I don't want to give anything away when it comes to that, but definitely play it. It is an adventure game.
Yeah, but that's DLC. You need to own Sea of Thieves to play it. You can't just buy it on its own. So unfortunately, that leaves me high and dry. So I'll have to live vicariously through you.
Huh. I like that. Nice word, too.
So make it interesting.
Oh, boy. You know what's talking about interesting? We have Julia Minamata. She's been waiting in the green room in the conservatory. Let's bring her in. How you doing,
Yay,
Julia?
Welcome,
hey,
Julia.
Hi, guys. No, I'm doing very, very well. How are you guys?
Oh, man. Wonderful. Absolutely. Wonderful. And I got to say, I love the background.
Thank you. What
room do we have here?
This is the Conservatory of the Crimson Lodge. You can actually go into this room and have a seat on the blue couch behind me. And yeah, just enjoy, take it all in, really.
So
of course, it's inspired by the Clue in Conservatory with the tiles.
Yeah, I was going to say, who done it? It was Julia with the candlestick in the conservatory.
Yep. Exactly.
Oh, sorry, I gave it away.
Spoilers.
Right, just outside the screen is like the secret passageway where you come on up in there. You don't see it on the screen. It's secret.
It's secret.
And if you guys don't know, Julia, like she had just kind of referenced right now, is the developer, artist, wonderful individual who is creating the Crimson Diamond. Beautiful, beautiful game. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Yeah, it is an adventure game. It is an adventure game that kind of looks like the older adventure games in the late 80s and early 90s. So this particular color palette that you're seeing here, it's that 16 color EGA color palette. It's going to sound like the old games. It's got an original score by Dan Pollockart that is being composed on a Roland MT32, which was the gold standard at the time. And so we kind of wanted to look and sound and kind of play like the old games, but I've taken a lot of lessons from, you know, the intervening years since 1989 to now about just quality of life improvements towards game design, like having an in-game notebook like Thimbleweed Park has, so players can keep track of their objectives better. There is an autosave function as well that you can turn on and off, like stuff like that. I mean, I wanted it to look and feel like we all kind of have that, those warm, fuzzy, nostalgic memories, but also, yeah, make it a little bit easier for people to play.
Yeah, bring all the good stuff. Leave all the frustrations.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Hopefully, yes. Hopefully.
So tell us about the game itself. Like, what is it all about? Who's in it? You know, I know a little bit, but some of our listeners may not be.
Of course. Yeah, it is. It is so mysteries that is set in Northern Ontario. I'm an Ontarian. I'm in Toronto here.
Me too. Yep.
Yeah. Yay. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Canada represent.
Represent.
Go Maple Leafs.
Go. Yeah. Go. Go Maple Leafs. If that's your thing. But yes. It's based in Northern Ontario. It's based in a lot of the ghost towns and things that happened in Ontario, also in other provinces. And this one is based around a place called Crimson, Ontario, and up in Northern Ontario, that was a mining town, a garnet mining town. And the idea being, in the introductory sequence, there is a diamond that's found in the belly of a fish, and that kind of triggers this whole rush, like a diamond rush, I suppose you could call it, to the area. And you get sent as Nancy Maple, a wannabe geologist, mineralogist. You get sent on assignment from the Royal Canadian Museum to investigate that claim. And of course, there's a bunch of other people that converge and stay at the one lodge, and they all kind of have their own schemes and their own plots and all that. And you get to hopefully figure out what's going on and maybe solve some mysteries, maybe do some field work, all that kind of fun stuff, and see what you find at the end. We'll see. It's kind of up to you.
Well, I think we can say it certainly looks like a Laura Bow style game. Yes. Would you say that was an inspiration for you?
Huge inspiration. Absolute number one inspiration for me. Because not even just the graphics, which the Sierra SCI-0 graphics, gorgeous graphics, not just that, but the genre of a mystery and a house. I first started off with adventure games with the King's Quest series. Mm-hmm. And I like fantasy, but there's something about this. It was, you know, this contemporary setting and this beautiful, spooky house. I consider it like a sub niche genre where you've got these adventure games that have house as the main setting, like Maniac Mansion and Day of the Tentacle, and of course the Colonel's Bequest as well. Last Half of Darkness. Yeah, I love having that as the backdrop for a game. And when I started making Crimson Diamond, I was just deciding, well, I would like to create pixel art, but I want to start with a visual reference. And the first one that came to my head was my absolute favorite, Colonel's Bequest. And not even just from the art, but also, you know, the music that I'm going to be having in it. And the story, of course, too. And the character who is, Nancy.
Look at that.
Yeah, embroidered hat. Yeah, Nancy Maple is, of course, very much based on Laura Bow.
This girl has merch.
Have merch.
That's quality. Good. That's a good job on that.
So it's beautiful. Here's another one. Well, where this one might be familiar to people who are familiar with Adventure Game Hotspot, because Adventure Game Geek has the black version of this bucket hat.
He does on his videos. Man, I didn't realize that's where that came from.
Yes. Awesome. And also another Adventure Game Hotspot person is One Short Eye, who has that same bucket on a t-shirt that he's worn on a couple of his videos too. So there is an Adventure Game Hotspot connection here for sure with the merch.
That's great, man.
Well, boy, if you're offering free stuff, you can send someone. No, I'm just
You know what? They actually ordered that stuff. So I did
yes,
not.
Yes, I was going to say they deserve to be ordered. So they look
That's
really
expensive.
Good.
Merchandise is a fortune right now. Holy moly.
Well, I use something called Fourth Wall, and it's all print on demand. So actually what's kind of cool about this is usually with embroidery, they require like minimum orders or something. But Fourth Wall, it's print on demand. So there's no upfront cost for me whatsoever. Mm-hmm. They handle everything, and it's fantastic. So.
Convenience, too. I like it.
I love the cap there because Nancy's sideways, right? So I bet if you're watching, you'd probably be looking at people coming towards you with your head.
Well, the reason it's like that is because the embroidery area is this. It's like a long, narrow strip.
Right. No,
I wanted to maximize that.
I just think it'd be so funny to see people, you know, cranking their necks 90 degrees to see what's on your cap.
I'm thinking about having a one where she's flipped the other way. So you could have one where she's this orientation and one where she's that other orientation.
I got it, Julia. The next one in honor of Laura Bow. She needs maybe a death. Is there going to be deaths in the game?
There are. There is currently a demo available that is chapter one. The game is going to be 7 chapters long, but chapter one is available as a demo on Steam and on Itch.io and on Fireflower Games. And there are 2 deaths. Mm-hmm. In the demo, but you kind of have to work for them. I didn't want to go with the Sierra philosophy of very, very, very dangerous instant death. type of a thing. But yeah, there are two in there if you're willing to really try hard for them.
It would have been great for your merch. She's already laying sideways. You know, like, I achieved a Crimson Diamond death.
exactly. Oh, that would have been good because I do have that sprite.
So there's a bit of Laura Beau influence, obviously, but I get kind of another similarly named sleuth vibe from this. I'm thinking of Miss Marple from Agatha Christie. Is it safe to assume you're kind of a whodunit fan and maybe Agatha Christie in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Nancy Maple, the name, of course, is very much Miss Marple, Miss Maple, Nancy Maple, Nancy Drew, and then that Canadian twist of Maple. And in fact, yeah, I have to, like, I guess I can show, I just happen to have this on me. But yeah, I mean, I've got this. This is Agatha Christie, Murder of Roger Ackroyd. And this
Nice.
My mom has this wonderful collection of these original 70s paperbacks of that. So yes, I have a deep love of Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes, Columbo. A lot of like this. I have a subscription to BritBox, so I watch a lot of BritBox. The Tower is one that I'd recommend. That one is like a fairly recent one. It's excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the game. It has been a combination of my interest in mineralogy, geology, my interest in like Northern Ontario local history, my interest in mysteries. Everything has kind of been kind of put together in one little thing where I'm just like, I love all these things, and I get to put them all together and make one thing that's going to be like a love letter to so many different things at once.
Now, is Nancy kind of a super sleuth like a Poirot or a Sherlock Holmes? Or because she's young and she's sort of inexperienced, is she more of the, you know, kind of average Joe sort of, or Jane, I guess I should say.
Average Jane.
Sorry, Nancy.
she is average Jane. And what I like particularly about the Laura Beau character, right, especially in the first one, is that she's just a normal person. She's not a genius. She's not a gorgeous person. Like, that's not where she's coming from. She is a very relatable character, being normal person, average person, not particularly strong and dexterous, and she's not extremely clever or anything. It's very much, here's this person that is going to be solving this thing. It's going to be amazing, but normal people have that within their capacity too. And I like that relatable aspect of the character in her art and how the player plays her too. Yeah.
Yeah. I always felt there was like a bit of a disconnect whenever I'm playing a Sherlock Holmes or a Poirot. It's like, I'm not those guys. I'm
just
a dope who's trying to figure things out. You know what I mean? So I need somebody more on my level who is learning things as I am. So I think that
filter
works,
it down,
works
dumb
well.
It down for me so I can help.
That's a really good point, actually, because I mean, when you're watching a movie or reading a book, if the if the protagonist is a few steps ahead of the reader, then that's great, and we can feel like, okay, this is a very smart person and stuff. Right. But in these detective games, we're that person,
right?
And you know, we can't, you know, most of us aren't geniuses, and so it's kind of impossible to play, have a character and you be that character and have them be at a higher level of intelligence than what most of us, I think, have. Yeah.
You know, this is slightly off topic, but not really. I don't know, because speaking of Inspector Poirot, I was just at the movies yesterday and I saw a preview for A Haunting in Venice. Have you guys heard of that? Like, that looks I couldn't believe that was what the basis of that movie was. What, it looks insane. Have you seen it?
I have not seen that trailer, but it's a Kenneth Branagh. Is it another one of Poirot with Kenneth Branagh in it?
Yes.
He's done he did Murder on the Orient Express, and that you can watch that on Netflix. He also did one on the Nile. I can't remember what the name was. Death on the Nile. And then that's his third Poirot movie, I think. Yeah.
It looks legitimately scary, like a legitimate horror ghost type of things.
That's
it
great.
Looks interesting. Sorry. Didn't mean to sidestep, like I thought that was a really interesting thing that you guys might have something to say. But I will ask you, okay, so it looks like judging from the on demand, the streaming that you've done and everything, we have an older setting. Now we're based in the early 1900s, mm-hmm. am I right?
Yes.
And how come you chose that setting?
Partly it's, you know, that nostalgia aspect of Agatha Christie and Sherlock Holmes and the rest of it. Partly it's the practicalities of writing. I mean, people have gone to great lengths to describe how difficult it is to make a mystery when everyone's got like their phone, which has every bit of information and contact. And the reason I set it up in like a Northern Ontario remote town is this idea where there is no authority figure to come in and tell everyone what to do. You kind of, it's like a frontier type of thing. You kind of have to figure things out on your own. It's kind of up to you. Mm-hmm. That kind of aspect I really like. I also, it also has to do with the time period that the game is set in. It is kind of important, I think, because it was kind of at a time that was post that. So during the late 1800s in Canada, there was this huge like idea where the government is trying to encourage people to expand into those northern areas. And they, you know, they made all these treaties with First Nations people. And of course, we all know how that went, not that great for the First Nations people. Mm-hmm. But this, you know, that fallout and what happens when these mining towns that really did spring up quite a lot during the late 1800s, early 1900s, that then, you know, kind of became deserted, that era is very much what I was wanting to recreate for my game. And that was part of the reason. There's a lot of reasons for the setting being what it is. But yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the major factors. Yeah.
So that puts the game sort of in the era of World War One. Correct? Does that factor into the story at all?
Yes, it factors in a little bit. I don't want to spoil anything, but yeah, is a significant world event. I kind of was thinking that was an understatement. World War One is a significant world event. I was thinking a bit about, you know, Jeeves and Wooster of P.G. Wodehouse's, mm-hmm. where it's this idea of there are these things that are going on in the world that are very significant and very huge, but then you can have these smaller stories that are just kind of separate, almost away. It's almost like you're in a separate world. Mm-hmm. And I really like the Jeeves and Wooster books and stories for that. And that idea of, yeah, having it be before these very, very huge events that really did change everything for the whole world. I like that idea too, for that era.
Now, you've mentioned a couple times here, separate, you know, keeping things separate. You've mentioned isolation, mm-hmm. everything yes. in Canada. So are we staying strictly inside the house? Are we venturing out? Is there other locations besides just the house?
Right. The demo is chapter one that is just inside the house. Mm-hmm. But in chapter two and onward, you're going to get to move outside of the house. There's some outbuildings. There's a mm-hmm. boathouse. There's a garden shed. And there's other smaller locations. But it's very much all in one kind of a very fixed area. So yeah, you don't go out into the town and you don't go out into the forest or anything like that.
It is Clue.
Yeah, it's very much, yeah, like, so even in structure, it mm-hmm. is kind of that idea of that very specific type of mystery where it's all kind of in one location. Think of, yeah, Murder on the Orient Express. It's sure. all on that one train. And for me, it kind of lets me concentrate on developing a setting over time and just having things happen in different things happening in the same locations and characters moving through rooms and everything. I like the idea of everyone kind of being stuck in that same area, because otherwise if you don't get along with someone, you can just leave. But for these people, they're just kind of in a remote area, and then you kind of have to argue and get along or whatever you're going to do with the people that you're keeping company with. And I do like that aspect too, for the drama aspect.
Yeah, there's a real, you know, positive aspect to it, a kind of claustrophobia when you're dealing with mm-hmm. kind of a, you know, a mystery and suspicious people and probably some unpleasant people. I'm not necessarily, I'm not speaking for you, but I would imagine there are probably a few people with sort of less than ideal personalities.
Well, absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the other people that we'll meet at the lodge?
Yes. Okay. Well, the owner of the lodge is Mr. Richards, and he's that curmudgeonly recluse type of character who doesn't want any of these people in his house. But
that's perfect.
He has to kind of deal with that because of this big diamond rush. His sister has come up from the city. She had left that area when she was a very young person. And of course, this promise of riches has brought her back up to, you know, her childhood home. And she brought a lawyer. And also the Canadian government has sent a mineralogist, an expert mineralogist, to evaluate the claim as well. There are a few interesting people. They all have kind of conflicting goals. And that's kind of a really big thing about having this be an interesting story whatsoever is having these people kind of butting up against each other and all wanting different things and all trying to figure out different ways of getting those things that they want. And some people have a flexible sense of ethics, to put it lightly. Yeah,
I like that. A flexible sense of ethics. Awesome. Okay, so right now, or you're just working on English? Are we yes. sticking with English? Are we going to get more translations mm-hmm. coming along the lines? I know that's kind of expensive, right?
Yeah. So there are a lot of reasons, and just with everything else, we talked about, you know, the setting and things like this. Mm-hmm. As with anything else in the game, there's, you know, like half a dozen reasons for basically mm-hmm. the way everything is, and one of them, yeah, localization. It's expensive. It's a text parser game, so that adds another layer of difficulty. There is a lot of text in the game, and I'm just doing this myself. I mean, of course, I've got Dan Policar doing the music, but as a solo dev, I'm doing every other aspect of it, and I'm doing this self-publishing too. So that means I don't have a lot of like resources or expertise even. To do localization, and the same goes for like voice acting and things like that as well. Like everything, these very resource heavy, money heavy type of propositions. I'm just gonna like launch, and people have asked me about, oh, you know, would you like to localize to this or this or that? And I always give them the same answer, and the same with porting it the game as well. I said I would. These are questions that I hope I have to deal with later on. Mm-hmm. In that, hopefully, the game will launch really well, and then there'll be a demand for that. Possibly down the road, but at the moment I'm just trying to keep things like very manageable and small, just for my own like sanity really, because I got to keep all these different plates spinning, and that would be an extra plate.
And yeah. For our benefit too, I definitely like the idea of having the text parser. Would you consider that to be easier to develop a game with a text parser or not?
In some ways it's pretty tricky. Mm-hmm. Trickier than the regular, like a full point and click interface, because you have to anticipate what the player might try. And I've tried really hard to make my text parser something that's going to be as responsive as possible, because people, yeah, they will write in different ways, and how to even tell them what they can, what nouns they can verb, that type of thing, that can be very tricky too. I've said this in other places, but the idea of waste paper basket, trash can, bin, there's so many different ways to call that thing, and you just
monkey
have to
wrench.
You keep on adding. Exactly. Like whenever you have language involved in a very integrated way, it's going to be very tricky, and I don't want the game to be unenjoyable because of the text parser. Mm-hmm. I want that text parser to enhance people's enjoyment and their immersion in the game, and that part is definitely trickier than if you just had a universal pointing and clicking type of interface. But by that same token, I do find that when I play a text parser adventure game, I immediately am just so much more immersed than if I was playing something point and click. And it is tough. It's tough to do, but I'm sure the other one also presents its own challenges too.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, if the text parser works properly or works well, and I have many a nightmare from games that not do it well, it really does open things up. You feel like you have some control more than, well, I'll click and see what this does, you know?
Yes.
But so when you get into playtesting, if you're not already, you might want to have your testers like record a list of everything they tried that didn't work. And, you know,
there is a parser log in the game that I have programmed. Yeah. So what happens with that is it starts off being off, but what it does, it kind of has like it generates a file whenever anyone enters in a word that's not in the parser dictionary, it records that word into its own files. I can review that and see what words I might want to include. Another really valuable part of testing is watching streamers play the demo, because I can see live what they're trying, and I've taken notes every time someone's played it. A lot of times they are finding bugs, but sometimes it's just a matter of, oh, well, maybe you could use that word as well, and then I try my best to accommodate that.
That's great. So you mentioned your own interest in mineralogy, and Nancy is a budding mineralogist.
Yes.
As someone who is most definitely not a mineralogist, a head full of rocks is not the same as having a head for rocks. So how much of a factor is that in the actual gameplay? Or is it at all? Is that just more of a background?
There's definitely aspects of it in the game.
Please make it easy.
Oh, no, it is. It's very, 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 very basic.
Okay, good. Good. My alley then.
Yeah, no spoilers. But one of the first things that happens in the introductory sequence, as you're taking a train to Crimson, and Nancy has brought her kit and everything like that, and it gets her luggage gets lost along the way, and you're going to have to improvise those tools for chapter two. And then you also get to do a little bit of field work in chapter two. It's there, and I wanted to, I didn't want to make it like a super educational game, but it's kind of accidentally educational in a few ways that, yeah, I mean, you get the very, very basics of how to do field work. At the same time, sometimes Nancy will talk about, if you look at a particular boulder, she might have something interesting to say about that boulder or that kind of a boulder. And that's just a result of me getting to really nerd out on, you know, all the different aspects of geology that I could find in that. So that's been educational for me. In fact, I have, my rock collection has really grown since I've been developing this game, because I'm actually finding myself enjoying it even more and more as I've been going through the game.
Yeah, you seem like you have very specific interests. I'd actually like to know a little bit more about you. Maybe we'll talk about your entry into adventure gaming for sure. But let's actually start with right here. Tell us about your favorites, a few of your favorite adventure games in the past. Right. I'm guessing Lorebo's on there.
Yes, yeah, that's by default. Yeah, Colonel's Bequest. Not only we've talked about the graphics, we've talked about the genre, but also the gameplay is surprisingly modern for the time, and also surprisingly modern compared to the King's Quest games, because this game you can't really get stuck in it too much. I mean, you can basically wander around and kind of get to an ending that might not be the best ending, but you will get an ending. And so it's a much more story focused than puzzle focused. And I even remember at the time, there is a Computer Gaming World review of the Colonel's Bequest. And yeah, one of the criticisms that people had was like, yeah, it's not as puzzle heavy as a lot of adventure games, because at that time, you know, the puzzle was the king of what the mechanic is you'd expect of these types of games. But the Colonel's Bequest focused more on the story and the characters, and which is what I find really, really appealing. And I think even like more modern adventure games also tend to focus more on the stories, and with like less on really obscure puzzles that are just either don't make sense or are just extremely, extremely obscure. And that's definitely up there for me. The Secret of Monkey Island is also a super, super favorite. In fact, that's probably the one I enjoyed playing the most when I was a kid, especially the EGA version of that. I stream on Tuesdays, like my game art, and I also stream playing adventure games. And I've so far been able to just play EGA versions of things, which I love to do. Even though it can be difficult, especially for something like LucasArts, to find the EGA version of their games. Mm-hmm. I guess I could add to that list is Loom and the EGA version. EGA version of Loom is kind of tricky to get. So that's something else that I kind of wish they made more available commercially. I just finished Loom. I also played Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade EGA, Rise of the Dragon EGA. All these games kind of had EGA versions. Some of them seem more like afterthoughts, but at least with Secret of Monkey Island, it started off as an EGA game. It's totally gorgeous. So that one for sure. Colonel's Bequest, The Secret of Monkey Island. I also love Day of the Tentacle. I think that one has the best puzzles. Mm-hmm. Also wonderful, wonderful voice acting as well.
So EGA is your preference.
EGA is my preference. Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask. Why is that? What is it about EGA that appeals to you so much?
I think part of it is the colors are just so bright, and I love seeing different artists solve that problem of how are we going to use this very limited palette in ways to convey, you know, whatever we're trying to convey. I love that, the problem solving aspect of it. I was a freelance illustrator for 10 years before I started doing game dev, and I did silkscreen printing. And silkscreen printing requires you to be very, very selective about the colors you're using. Mm-hmm. I used about 6 colors maximum on my silkscreen prints. And that got me thinking about very limited color palettes. I just gravitate more toward limited color palettes. Also, there is this, back in the day, the transition from EGA to VGA, I still enjoyed VGA games, but that transition where you had beautiful, vector, like crisp, 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 clean pixel art. And then we moved into VGA, which was kind of like a low res, like scanned art of painted work. And it kind of looked blurry to me. And the items and the sprites could sometimes look kind of not a part of the background. They weren't as well integrated between background and foreground and the objects that you could use and animated aspects of the screen. That part of EGA I love. It was beautifully clear and everything kind of integrated well, like all the different elements integrated seamlessly with each other. Those are kind of, yeah.
Oh, I was gonna say, with a lesser palette, it's more distinction between those beautiful bright colors.
Yeah. I just the creativity that was forced on those artists at the mm-hmm. time to solve all these problems. But I think my taste is generally gravitating toward the brighter colors. But when they didn't have a choice, it was amazing what they could achieve. I mean, looking at the Colonel's Bequest, it's a very moody, mm-hmm. spooky kind of ambience, but they were able to do that with exactly the same colors, you know, that I'm using, or, you know, something like, I don't know, any other EGA game had that same toolbox. I love seeing that the different styles and the different the way that the palette gets used. I get really excited about it.
Well, you're a good example of quite the authority when it comes to choosing artistic colors and to have this actual conversation, because I've seen your work outside of the computer game development aspect of it. You're good. Tell us a little bit about your artistic history.
Sure, thank you. Yeah, no, thank you very much. You'll notice in my actual professional work, my illustration portfolio, mm-hmm. a lot of very bright colors, and it's still a limited color palette. Even when I transitioned from doing silkscreen into just digital color, I still used fairly limited color palettes. I did go to school for illustration. I have a bachelor's of applied arts illustration, and then I went to work trying to become a freelance illustrator and kind of trying to build a career for myself in that part, which was really difficult because I graduated at a time where there was a recession, and even nowadays with like online magazines and stuff, the print stuff was starting to fall away, and the budgets were kind of not increasing. In fact, the art departments would get smaller, and I don't even think that the fees have increased since the time when I got started, and probably even from an earlier time. It's been stagnated, which is kind of difficult, but I loved working in magazines and newspapers. Of course, I don't know, Jack, you know, you being a fellow Torontonian, fellow Canadian, Maclean's Magazine, I did a ton of work for Maclean's. The National Post, I got to do a few like really big, long newspaper illustrations for that. In the States, I worked for the New Yorker, which was like my absolute dream, mm-hmm. because they use a lot of illustration, and it's a beautifully written and beautifully art directed magazine. But I kept working and trying to hustle for work, and I felt like I was not making the progress that I wanted to. I wasn't building any momentum with it, and I had a lot of free time, and that's when I started to look into pixel art just as a hobby, really. And that's where I started. And I think I started naturally going back to those happy golden memories of my childhood, which was Colonel's Bequest kind of looking era. And it's easier when you're starting with something like pixel art to start, okay, well, I have no idea where to start. Well, okay, well, here is the, you know, they use 320 by 200 resolution. That's a good place to start. Okay, here's this color palette. That's a good place to start. Already, I'm not having to, you know, come up with any solutions for something when I already have like a set color palette, a set resolution. That's a really good starting point. And also just the wealth of screenshots you can find on the internet for these things as well. Like that all was a huge education for me in terms of showing light and shadow and how to render stuff.
So, I mean, obviously you have great talent as an artist, but you didn't just join up with another studio and provide the art. You're making the entire game. As far as I know, you're doing the writing, yes. you're doing the programming is what you're doing everything. Like at what point did you go, hey, I can do all of it. I don't have to just stop at making art. I can do the whole thing. And I'm going to.
Well, it kind of happened really slowly. It kind of crept up on me. It was a matter of, okay, I hear a couple rooms that I made, and that was really cool. I've got these little pixel art rooms that kind of look like old games that I remember playing. And then me just wanting to do more and just slowly teaching myself different aspects of what that means. I want a little sprite character, and how do I animate something? I just started to slowly teach myself step by step everything until eventually I'd learned enough to say, oh, actually, I feel like I've gotten enough of a knowledge base to maybe actually do this thing to actually make a game, because now I'm starting to learn some, you know, adventure game studio. I'm starting a little bit of programming. I can animate a little bit. Writing was fine because I was always really good in English class and stuff like that. And If someone had approached me at the beginning and said, okay, well, if you want to make a game, this is everything you need to know and this is everything you need to do, I'd be like, super intimidated. Yeah, I would have been like, no, no, no. Mm-hmm. But because this all happened very slowly over a period of years and very organically based on what I felt like, I don't know how to do that. So maybe I'll try to figure out that next step. I just like step by step, it built into something that started to become like a game. I was just like, okay, well, I can, you know, okay, well, I want to do a text price. So, well, how do I do that? And to its credit, Adventure Game Studio has a wonderful community that's super helpful, mm-hmm. which is very important when you're trying to learn something, because, you know, there was no like university or college course or night school course on Adventure Game Studio. It was all kind of YouTube tutorials, which was invaluable. Mm-hmm. And also when I had very specific questions, they just were wonderful at helping out with that as well. There was a point, I think, about the time when I actually created the first earlier versions of the demo, which was like in 2018 when I showed it at Wordplay here in Toronto. I said, actually, yeah, I think I have all this, the, you know, the tools and the know-how that I need to make a full game of this. And that was really exciting to me, because up until that point, I was just at this, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm just kind of bungling along. But when you actually get to bring something to a show and show people and they can respond to it and look at it, then it's like, oh, this is suddenly becoming a real thing. And maybe it could expand into something more than this.
Mm. So is this what you're doing right now? Is this how you're playing the bills, or are you doing something else? Are you good? Are you going back to being an outside game dev artist?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I am. So I am self-publishing, self-funding this mm-hmm. game based because of my savings. I did manage to scrape together some savings, but also along the way, like during the time from 2018 to now, I've actually worked on contract work on some projects. Mm-hmm. That includes, I've worked on a few games with Strange Scaffold. So that is Space Warlord Organ Trading Simulator. I have done some art for that game. I've done another game that's been released. Another game that's been released is called Witch Strandings with Strange Scaffold. I also was the art director and did a lot of art for a Playdate game called Recommendation Dog. And that was with Sweet Baby and Strange Scaffold. And also with Sweet Baby, I've also done some like narrative consultation, some cultural sensitivity consultation with them, like on like contract work here and there. Mm-hmm. That's definitely helped me kind of pay the bills and manage my expenses and everything. Building those connections in the industry. So whatever happens, no matter how the game launches, and I hope it does well, but even if it doesn't, I'm looking at other avenues that I can pursue potentially. I still want to make a sequel, but I understand that depending on how well this does, it'll be either 100% on the sequel or maybe part-time on a sequel and then part-time doing contract work, maybe even full-time at a studio as well. I would be totally open to that too. The next year is going to be real interesting to see where I land. That's been helpful. I have a Patreon, which is awesome. People have been really wonderfully supportive mm-hmm. of me on that. I do stream on Twitch and I get a little bit of money coming in from that. The merch stuff, you know, mm-hmm. there's a bunch of little things that kind of like all kind of trickle in and add up to just being enough to kind of get me by until I finish this game.
Well, I certainly wish you luck. I mean, I'm very, very excited. I've been watching this for quite a while. I do see quite a bit of your streams, and you know, I mentioned this to a couple of people. I really respect. It seems like the modern way of marketing. You got to get out there. You got to put your face out there, and you do such a good job at it. And,
oh, thank you.
Whereas we probably wouldn't know about the game if you were not putting yourself out there as much as you do. So I think you're doing a great job. I really, really look forward to what you have in the future with this game.
Well, thank you so much, Josh, because yeah, it's a lot of work. And that's part of the reason why, you know, I keep on pushing that date back, is because it's not, you know, of course we talked about, okay, well, I do the art and I do the animation, I do the writing, I do the programming. There's so much more to it than that, right? Mm-hmm. There's the marketing aspect. There's, okay, yeah, there's the streaming, and then there's doing, you know, like designing the merch stuff. And then there's doing stuff like this. So coming to talk to you guys, mm-hmm. which I love to do, but that's definitely a huge part of it too. I have a newsletter that I put out every month, the Crimson Gazette. So please, you know, go to the crimsondiamond.com and subscribe to the newsletter.
Yes, Sue, it's a great read. I always make sure I read it every month.
Oh, thank you, Jack. I had no idea. That's wonderful.
Telling you.
Yeah. there's so much work that is not directly having to do with developing the game that is so necessary to hopefully giving yourself the best chance of launching well. It's always going to be a crapshoot. You know, there's so much involved in terms of timing, whatever else is coming out at that time, a lot of luck. You just really never know. And I just want to give myself the absolute best chances at having this do well as I possibly can.
So have you given, I mean, this is obviously a passion project for you, all your sort of loves rolled into one, mm-hmm. as you said, but it's also a very retro game and unapologetically yes. retro game, even though it's got a few modern conveniences, but yes. it's still very retro. So how do you market a 1989 game in mm-hmm. 2023? Because like people that grew up loving Laura Beau don't need to be sold. They're in already, but you know, yeah. lots of other gamers weren't around then. How do you get them involved? How do you draw them right. in?
Yeah, that's also an awesome question and something I have had to think about, because yeah, taking it to shows, not a lot of people quite a few people do recognize it, but a lot of people just were not born when mm-hmm. when these games initially yeah, yeah. came out. And what I've kind of tried to do is yeah, make the game accessible, approachable to people. And there's a few different ways I've tried to do that. One of them is there is a tutorial room that you can try that kind of walks the player through, okay, this is how you move in a game like this. This is how you, you know, you can type open, you know, some of the very most common commands. I kind of walk the player through that and how that all works. So that's the number one thing. Number two, in terms of marketing the game to people who've never played a game like this, particularly something like a text parser, I think it's a really exciting opportunity to show them a style of game that they've never seen before, that I think is the perfect time for it to come back, because we're all on our phones, we're all like texting and messaging. It's so text-based now, the type of communication that we're doing, mm-hmm. that to play True. A game with that type of interface, I think people would be ready for that. And I think there, I mean, I'm not the only game developer that is working with text parser, but I think I think people would be really excited by that. And if once they get to experience a really well done text parser and maybe get engaged with the story, they'd be interested in exploring more text parser games. Because yes, a lot of these things can be playable. My game's not going to be playable necessarily on a phone, but there are a lot of kind of small, like just Twine or text-based games that you can just play on your phone, interactive yeah. fiction. I think narrative, like maybe not necessarily adventure game genre, of course I hope for that as well, but games that are very narrative focused or very story based, I think there's a huge like broad audience for something like that, because everyone loves stories and the idea of being able to actively participate in a story that might not necessarily have like twitchy gameplay and you don't have to like shoot people in the head or something like that. Right, yeah. I think there's a huge appeal for people to have like a nice story based experience. And we're kind of seeing that with a lot of the kind of indie games that are coming out that are story focused, even like walking simulator type of games, where if there's not so much like resource management, or you're not having to build a base and stuff like that. We just want to have these experiences. And I think that's a really promising trend too.
And when do you think that we will be able to see the game? Not putting you on the spot, but I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit.
Yes, that's the question. You know, honestly, I still hope to launch this year, but honestly, I've internally pushed back the launch date about 4 times. And every time I look back at when, you know, the first time I think anyone ever asked me about this game, I think it was... was it a German site or something? Anyway, somebody asked me, I think in 2018 or 2019, when it was going to be done. And I said that year. And now I look back and I just laugh and I laugh. Yeah. I still hope this year, but it's just, just everything takes so long. I would not be surprised if I pushed it back. And that's okay, because like I said, I only have myself to answer to, really. Everyone has been super supportive and patient about the game up to this point. And yeah, I'm not going to try to push it out the door before it's ready, for sure.
Yeah, no. Worst thing, you know, you've been working on it for all these years. The worst thing you can do is just force it at the end, just to reach an arbitrary date that matters to nobody. So
exactly. Yeah, I'm really, I mean, in some ways I am fortunate, because I don't really have anyone to answer to in that way. So there is no external pressure, really. Of course, I want to get the game out as soon as I can realistically get it out, because I do want to share it with people. And I do want to, figure out what's going to be next for me. And that's kind of a big open question.
Well, you've answered a lot of questions today. I mean, I really, really appreciate you coming on. We're still got a little bit of fun to have here, but before we jump over to the next segment, we're gonna talk about our favorite Sierra desk shortly.
Yes.
Is there anything else that people may not know about Crimson Diamond that you want to share today on this episode of Adventure Game Hotspot Podcast?
Well, people might want to know it, and I haven't said. Okay, let's see. Well, okay, this is something that might be fun for people who have a fondness for the old adventure games, and especially something like a day-night cycle, mm-hmm. that type of idea. The game does happen over, I think, two or three days, and I, for me as an artist and someone who's so focused on palette, I love the idea of doing a day version of a scene and a night version of a scene. Quest for Glory, which is probably my favorite Sierra series, uses that to the best advantage, especially in those EGA games where you couldn't just put like a blue filter on top of something and say, that's nighttime. No, they actually had to like redraw and consider the color uses they were gonna do. I also love the idea of having a game that happens over multiple days, and seeing how people change or how, you know, what they're up to and stuff like that. So the game does happen over a period of a few days, and I like that type of thing, and I like getting to see like the day and night version of the same screens.
It makes a difference. It feels different. It mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't feel like you're in the same place, you know, all the time, even though you aren't.
It should add a level of charm, and that's the stuff that it does, especially in this type of a game.
Yeah, I was really excited to get to do that with it. And the demo that people are going to play is going to be nighttime, but you're going to only get to be inside the lodge for mm-hmm. chapter one. But if you want to get a little sneak peek of what the game does look like at night, if you go upstairs and you go to the end of the hall, so you go south to the end of the hall and open up the balcony doors, you can actually go out and see what it would look like if you had access. Yes. Yeah. So you get to see.
I had to go out.
Of course you have to go out. That's what the game will get to look like for nighttime. And I was really happy that I got to do that. And I hope people will enjoy getting the different feel of what the game is, day versus night.
Oh man, here we go. I'm ready. You talked me into it. I'm ready to play the game. Julia, tell us where we can find you.
Absolutely. You can find me and the Crimson Diamond at thecrimsondiamond.com. That's going to be like all your social media stuff. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Mastodon. I've got, I'm on Twitch at @_MapleMystery. I am on YouTube as well. I put all my videos up on my YouTube channel. You can just find me at Julia Binamata at that. And what else? I've got a store on Fourth Wall. I've got a store on Society 6. And yes, please do, if you go to thecrimsondiamond.com, please do subscribe to the newsletter, because then it's like a long form, like a monthly thing where I just have links of all the videos and also like news and stuff and developers updates and Craft Corner and a rock fact and like a bunch of stuff in there. So please do subscribe to that. But yeah, I mean, you can also drop me an email. There's an email address too on the crimsondiamond.com site. So please, please wishlist the game on Steam. That's the mm-hmm. that's if you want to support the game, that's the absolute best thing you can do for it. And yeah, please play the demo and hope you like it. And let me know if you find a bug. That's also helpful. Let me know too. I don't have playtest.
Stream on Tuesdays, right?
Yes, I stream on Tuesdays. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. I stream mm-hmm. Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern at Crimson Tuesdays. Mm-hmm. And I tweet about that. So if you follow me on Twitter, I always tweet when I go live for that. I also have a Facebook fan page for the Crimson Diamond as well.
What about Threads? Yeah. Have you joined Threads yet?
I have not. I'm just like, I'm trying to.
It's so much work now, isn't it?
Oh, so no, it's so much social work. Medias. I have a Blue Sky profile, but I haven't done anything with it. There's just so much as a solo dev, more, like I said, more plates, more plates to spin, another plate over here. No, I haven't. Yeah. I mean, the Threads thing, I'm not sure. I'm just going to wait. You know, I'm hoping that it people stop using it so I don't have to start.
Oh boy. No, I don't think so. It's it's the hot ticket right now. Well, you could find Jack on AdventureGameHotspot.com. He lives there. He's got a couch in the back, like all day, daily content, lots and lots of content.
Amazing.
And we are, I guess I'll tell people, we're having a site. What do you call it? A renovation?
Oh, you're teasing this? Yeah, we're having a total major site rebuild.
Yeah.
Nice.
We thought we knew what we wanted when we built the we built the site last year, and then we have come to the conclusion that we want more and better and sleeker, and it will be that. So
yeah, well, we were gonna just kind of continue to iterate on what we started with, because like we sort of didn't really have the benefit of an artist originally. So we just wanted to get up and running, and we'll piece it together. But yeah, you know, we got more ambitious, and now we want to sort of really, you know, lean into it and do a whole rebuild. And we're redesigning the back end too, so it'll be sort of much more functional and more options than we have now. So yeah, exciting stuff. I'm really
very exciting. And now I'm gonna turn that question around on you guys. When is that launching?
Oh yeah. Oh gosh. I'll have to ask our designers that.
Yeah, the answer is in months rather than say weeks, let's say, but at least it's months rather than years.
But we do have something exciting coming up pretty soon. We will be announcing the nominees for the Adventure Game Hall of Fame, and that's coming up very, very quickly. Now, it's not going to be who's in the Hall of Fame, because we still have to send it out to a bunch of media members and have it voted. But we are very, very close to announcing the nominees.
Amazing.
The first-year nominees.
First year.
This inaugural. Is like an ongoing thing. So this is just our inaugural batch of inductees.
We have put in so much work. And so not just Jack and I, we're talking like our whole committees of committees to make this happen. And we are very, very excited about that. And you can find us anywhere, all the socials, including Threads. We're trying to build the Threads up, Venture Game Hotspot. Julia, appreciate you. Jack, as always. And you guys, we really appreciate you. Treat everybody well, and we'll see you all in the next video.
Thank you for having me. Bye.